obeys his master. The narrator is in a state of serenity and peace. He has tamed his wild spirit. That's what we are trying to do. Since ancient times, people have strived to train and control the forces that reside deep inside them so that they can find serenity, so that they can preserve and protect their accomplishments. What good is it to be rational at work if our personal lives are a hot-blooded series of disasters? How long can we keep the two domains separate anyway? You might rule cities or a great empire, but if you're not in control of yourself, it is all for naught. The work we must do next is less cerebral and more spiritual. It's work located in the heart and in the soul and not in the mind, because it is our soul that is the key to our happiness or our unhappiness, contentment or discontent, moderation or gluttony, and stillness or perturbation. That is why those who seek stillness must come to develop a strong moral compass, steer clear of envy and jealousy and harmful desires, come to terms with the painful wounds of their childhood, practice gratitude and appreciation for the world around them, cultivate relationships and love in their lives, place belief and control in the hands of something larger than themselves. Understand that there will never be enough and that the unchecked pursuit of more only ends in bankruptcy. Our soul is where we secure our happiness and unhappiness, contentment or emptiness, and ultimately determine the extent of our greatness. We must maintain a good one. Choose virtue. The essence of greatness is the perception that virtue is enough. Ralph Waldo Emerson. Marcus Aurelius famously described a number of what he called epithets for the self. Among his were upright, modest, straightforward, sane, cooperative. These were, then, the traits that served him well as emperor. There are many other traits that could be added to this list: honest, patient, caring, kind, brave, calm, firm, generous, forgiving, righteous. But there is one word, however, under which all these epithets sit: virtue. Virtue, the Stoics believed, was the highest good, the summum bonum, and should be the principle behind all our actions. Virtue is not holiness, but rather moral and civic excellence in the course of daily life. It's a sense of pure rightness that emerges from our soul and is made real through the actions we take. The East prized virtue as much as the West. The Tao Te Ching, for instance, actually translates as the way of virtue. Confucius, who advised many of the rulers and princes of his day, would have agreed with Marcus that a leader was well served by the pursuit of virtue. His highest compliment would have been to call a ruler a junzi, a word that translators still have trouble finding equivalents for in English, but is roughly understood as a person who emanates integrity, honor, and self-control. If the concept of virtue seems a bit stuffy to you, consider the evidence that a virtuous life is worthwhile for its own sake. No one has less serenity than the person who does not know what is right or wrong. No one is more exhausted than the person who, because they lack a moral code, must belabor every decision and consider every temptation. No one feels worse about themselves than the cheater or the liar, even if, often especially if, they are showered with rewards for their cheating and lying. Life is meaningless to the person who decides their choices have no meaning. Meanwhile, the person who knows what they value, who has a strong sense of decency and principle and behaves accordingly, who possesses easy moral self-command, who leans comfortably upon this goodness day in and day out, this person has found stillness, a sort of soul power they can draw on when facing challenges, stress, or even scary situations. Look at the response of Canadian politician Jagmeet Singh to an angry protester during a campaign stop. When the agitated woman came up and started shouting at him about Islam, despite the fact that he is a Sikh, he replied with two of his own epithets for the self, love and courage. Soon the crowd began to chant along with him, love and courage, love and courage, love and courage. He could have stood there and yelled back. He could have run away. It could have made him cruel and mean in the moment or forever after. He may well have been prodded in those directions, but instead he remained cool. And those two words helped him recenter in the midst of what not only was a career on the line situation, but probably felt like a life-threatening one. Different situations naturally call for different virtues and different epithets for the self. When we're going into a tough assignment, we can say to ourselves over and over again, strength and courage. Before a tough conversation with a significant other, patience and kindness. In times of corruption and evil, goodness and honesty. The gift of free will is that in this life, we can choose to be good or we can choose to be bad. We can choose what standards to hold ourselves to and what we will regard as important, honorable, and admirable. The choices we make in that regard determine whether we will experience peace or not, which is why each of us needs to sit down and examine ourselves. What do we stand for? What do we believe to be essential and important? What are we really living for? Deep in the marrow of our bones, in the chambers of our heart, we know the answer. The problem is that the busyness of life, the realities of pursuing a career and surviving in the world come between us and that self-knowledge. Confucius said that virtue is a kind of pole star. It not only provides guidance to the navigator, but it attracts fellow travelers too. Epicurus, who has been unfairly branded by history as a hedonist, knew that virtue was the way to tranquility and happiness. In fact, he believed that virtue and pleasure were two sides of the same coin. As he said, it is impossible to live the pleasant life without also living sensibly, nobly, and justly, and conversely, it is impossible to live sensibly, nobly, and justly without living pleasantly. A person who does not have a pleasant life is not living sensibly, nobly, and justly, and conversely, the person who does not have these virtues cannot live pleasantly. Where virtue is, so too are happiness and beauty. Confucius wrote that the gentleman is self-possessed and relaxed while the petty man is perpetually full of worry. It's worth a look at Seneca, another Stoic philosopher who, like Marcus, made his living in politics. Like us, Seneca was full of contradictions. On the one hand, his writings contain some of the most beautiful meditations on morality and self-discipline ever written, and they are obviously the result of incredible concentration and mental clarity. On the other, Seneca was a striver, an ambitious writer-politician who aspired to be remembered as much for his prose as for his policies. At the height of his career, he could be found working as a fixer for the Emperor Nero. Nero, although he had begun as a promising student of Seneca, did not make his teacher's job easy. He was deranged, selfish, distractible, paranoid, and cold-hearted. Imagine that you spend your evenings writing about the importance of doing the right thing, of temperance and wisdom, and then by day you have to help your all-powerful boss justify trying to assassinate his mother. Seneca knew he should walk away. He probably wanted to, but he never did. What is virtue? Seneca would ask. His answer, true and steadfast judgment. And from virtue comes good decisions and happiness and peace. It emanates from the soul and directs the mind and the body. Yet, when we look at Seneca's life, we get the sense that he was the type of man whose ambition did not provide much peace, but instead skewed his decision-making. Seneca wrote eloquently of the meaninglessness of wealth, yet came to possess an enormous fortune through questionable means. He believed in mercy, kindness, and compassion, but he willingly served two different emperors who were probably psychopaths. It was as if he didn't believe in his own philosophy enough to put it wholly into practice. he couldn't quite accept that virtue would provide enough to live on. Money, power, fame just seemed a little more urgent. Seneca knew of the virtuous path, but he chased the prizes that drew him away from it. This choice cost him many sleepless nights and forced him into ethically taxing dilemmas. In the end, it cost him his life. In 65 AD, Nero turned on his former teacher and forced him to commit suicide. The evil Seneca had rationalized for so long, it eventually cost him everything. There's no question it's possible to get ahead in life by lying and cheating and generally being awful to other people. This may even be a quick way to the top. But it comes at the expense of not only your self-respect, but your security too. Virtue, on the other hand, as crazy as it might seem, is a far more attainable and sustainable way to succeed. How's that? Recognition is dependent on other people. Getting rich requires business opportunities. You can be blocked from your goals by the weather just as easily as you can by a dictator. But virtue? No one can stop you from knowing what's right. Nothing stands between you and it but yourself. Each of us must cultivate a moral code, a higher standard that we love almost more than life itself. Each of us must sit down and ask, what's important to me? What would I rather die for than betray? How am I going to live and why? These are not idle questions or the banal queries of a personality quiz. We must have the answers if we want the stillness and the strength that emerges from the citadel of our own virtue. It is for the difficult moments in life, the crossroads that Seneca found himself on when asked to serve Nero, that virtue can be called upon. Heraclitus said that character was fate. He's right. We develop good character, strong epithets for ourselves, so when it counts, we will not flinch. So that when everyone else is scared and tempted, we will be virtuous. We will be still. Heal the inner child. The child is in me still, and sometimes not so still. Fred Rogers. There was always something childlike about Leonardo da Vinci. Indeed, this is what made him such a brilliant artist. His mischievousness, his curiosity, his fascination with inventing and creating. But behind this playfulness was a deep sadness, pain rooted in the events of his early life. Leonardo was born in 1452, an illegitimate son from a prosperous family of notaries. Though in time his father would invite his bastard son to come live with him and would help secure Leonardo's first artistic apprenticeship, a distance between them never closed. At the time, it was customary that the oldest son of a prominent tradesman like Leonardo's father would be chosen to take up his father's profession and eventually take over his business. While the Notary Guild technically did not recognize non-legitimo heirs, it's surprising that Leonardo's father never even attempted to appear before a local magistrate and present a petition to legitimate his son. Leonardo's father would go on to have 12 more children, 9 of whom were sons. When he died, he left no specific will, an act that for a notary familiar with the law meant one thing. He was legally disinheriting Leonardo in favor of his real children. As Leonardo's biographer Walter Isaacson would later write, by excluding Leonardo and never fully accepting him, Piero da Vinci's primary bequest to his son was to give him an insatiable drive for an unconditional patron. Indeed, all of Leonardo's artistic life exhibits an almost childlike search for love and acceptance from the powerful men he worked for. He devotedly served his first mentor, Andrea del Verrocchio, for more than 11 years, until Leonardo was 25, an incredibly long time for such a prodigal talent. Michelangelo, for example, broke out on his own at 16. What could have attracted a sweet soul like Leonardo to Cesare Borgia, a murderous psychopath? Borgia was the only patron who was willing to look at and consider Leonardo's military inventions, a longtime passion project. From Milan to France and to the Vatican itself, Leonardo traveled far and wide in his career, looking for the financial support and artistic freedom he thought would make him whole. Nearly half a dozen times, he uprooted himself and his workshop in a huff, leaving unfinished commissions behind him. Sometimes it was over a slight. Usually it was because the patron couldn't quite be everything Leonardo wanted. The subtext of his angry letters and half-completed works speaks as loudly to us today as any angry teenager. You're not my dad. You can't tell me what to do. You don't really love me. I'll show you. Many of us carry wounds from our childhood. Maybe someone didn't treat us right, or we experienced something terrible, or our parents were just a little too busy, or a little too critical, or a little too stuck dealing with their own issues to be what we needed. These raw spots shape decisions we make and actions we take, even if we're not always conscious of that fact. This should be a relief. The source of our anxiety and worry, the frustrations that seem to suddenly pop out in inappropriate situations, the reason we have trouble staying in relationships or ignoring criticism, it isn't us. Well, it is us, just not adult us. It's the 7-year-old living inside us, the one who was hurt by mom and dad, the sweet, innocent kid who wasn't seen. Think of Rick Ankiel, one of the greatest natural pitchers to ever play baseball. He had a brutal childhood in the home of an abusive father and a brother who was a drug dealer. His whole life, he stuffed this pain and helplessness down, focusing on his skill on the mound, eventually becoming the minor league's top pitching prospect. Then suddenly, just as his career was starting to go well, in the first game of the playoffs in 2000, in front of millions of people, he lost the ability to control his pitches. What happened? Just days before, his father and brother had gone to jail on drug charges, and Rick had been in the courthouse to see them. He'd been running from that pain and that anger for years until it finally exploded and shattered the delicate balance that pitching required. It took years of work with Harvey Dorfman, a brilliant, patient sports psychologist, to coax his gifts back. And even then, only so far. Ankiel would only pitch 5 more times in his career, none as a starter. The rest of his career he spent in the outfield, mostly in center field, the position farthest away from the mound. Sigmund Freud himself wrote about how common it is for deficiencies, big and small, at a young age to birth toxic, turbulent attitudes in adulthood. Because we weren't born rich enough, pretty enough, naturally gifted enough, because we weren't appreciated like other children in the classroom, or because we had to wear glasses or got sick a lot or couldn't afford nice clothes, we carry a chip on our shoulder. Some of us are like Richard III, believing that a deformity entitles us to be selfish or mean or insatiably ambitious. As Freud explained, we all demand reparation for our early wounds to our narcissism, thinking we are owed because we were wronged or deprived. This was Tiger Woods to the detail. It's dangerous business, though, creating a monster to protect your wounded inner child. The insecure lens, the anxious lens, the persecuted lens, the prove them all wrong lens, the will you be my father lens that Leonardo had. These adaptations developed early on to make sense of the world don't make our lives easier. On the contrary, who can be happy that way? Would you put a 9-year-old in charge of anything stressful or dangerous or important? The movie producer Judd Apatow has talked about something he realized after a big fight during the filming of one of his movies. For years, he had seen every note the studio or executives had for him, every attempt at restrictions or influence, as if it were the obnoxious meddling of his parents. Instinctively, emotionally, he had fought and resisted each intervention. Who are these idiots to tell me what to do? Why are they always trying to boss me around? Why are they so unfair? Each of us on occasion has surprised ourselves with a strong reaction to someone's innocuous comments, or thrown a fit when some authority figure tried to direct our actions, or felt the pull of an attraction to a type of relationship that never ends well, or the type of behavior we know is wrong. It's almost primal how deep these feelings go. They're rooted in our infancy. It took therapy and self-reflection, and probably the observations of his wife, for Apatow to understand that the movie studio was not his parents. It was a business transaction and a creative discussion, not another instance of a talented boy being bossed around by otherwise absent parents. But with that realization came stillness, if only because it de-intensified arguments at work. Think about it, how much better and less scary life is when we don't have to see it from the perspective of a scared, vulnerable child. How much lighter will our load be if we are not adding extra baggage on top? It will take patience and empathy and real self-love to heal the wounds in your life. As Thich Nhat Hanh has written, after recognizing and embracing our inner child, the third function of mindfulness is to soothe and relieve our difficult emotions. Just by holding this child gently, we are soothing our difficult emotions and we can begin to feel at ease. When we embrace our strong emotions with mindfulness and concentration, we'll be able to see the roots of these mental formations. We'll know where our suffering has come from. When we see the roots of things, our suffering will lessen. So mindfulness recognizes, embraces, and relieves. Take the time to think about the pain you carry from your early experiences. Think about the age of the emotional reactions you have when you are hurt or betrayed or unexpectedly challenged in some way. That's your inner child. They need a hug from you. They need you to say, hey, buddy, it's okay. I know you're hurt, but I'm going to take care of you. The functional adult steps in to reassert and reassure, to make stillness possible. We owe it to ourselves as well as to the people in our lives to do this. Each of us must break the link in the chain of what the Buddhists call samsara, the continuation of life's suffering from generation to generation. The comedian Gary Shandling lost his brother Barry at age 10 to cystic fibrosis and was left for the rest of his life at the mercy of his distraught and controlling mother, who was so disturbed by the loss of her older son that she forbade Gary from attending the funeral for fear that he would see her cry. But one day, as a much older man, Gary wrote in his diary a formula that might help him overcome that pain and not only heal his own inner child, but pass on the lesson to the many surrogate children he had as a mentor and elder in show business, one of whom was Judd Apatow. The formula was simple, and it is key to breaking the cycle and stilling the deep anguish we carry around with us. Give more, he said. Give what you didn't get. Love more. Drop the old story. Try it if you can. Beware desire. Every man has a passion gnawing away at the bottom of his heart, just as every fruit has its worm. Alexander Dumas. John F. Kennedy achieved indisputable greatness through stillness in those 13 fateful days in October 1962. The world is forever in his debt. But we should not allow that shining moment to obscure the fact that, like all of us, he had demons that dogged and haunted him and undermined that same greatness, and as a result, his stillness. Kennedy grew up in a house where his father often brought his mistresses home for dinner and on family vacations. It was a house where anger and rage were common too. When I hate some son of a bitch, Joseph Kennedy liked to say, I hate him until I die. It's probably not a surprise then that his young son would develop his own bad habits and wrestle with controlling his urges and appetites. The first time Kennedy's sex drive got him in trouble was during the early days of World War II, when he began dating Inga Arvad, a beautiful Dutch journalist who many suspected was a Nazi spy. When he was running for president, he had an affair with Judith Exner, who happened to be the girlfriend of Sam Giancana, a Chicago mobster. But instead of suffering any consequences for these massive lapses of judgment, Kennedy skated away clean each time, a fact that only escalated his risky behavior. Kennedy was no romantic. Girlfriends would describe his insatiable but joyless sex drive. According to one conquest, sex was just physical and social activity to him, a way to stave off the boredom or to get a rush. He didn't care about the other person, and in time he almost didn't care about the pleasure it gave himself either. As Kennedy told the Prime Minister of Britain in a moment of very uncomfortable honesty, if he went without sex for a few days, he'd get headaches. His father had told his sons that he couldn't sleep unless he'd had a lay. Given Kennedy's terrible back, having sex was probably painful too, but he never let that stop him. In one shameful moment, as Soviet and American forces teetered on the brink of nuclear war during the Cuban Missile Crisis, Kennedy brought in a 19-year-old student from Wheaton College for a rendezvous in a hotel near the White House. Here was a man who had no idea how much longer he would live, who was working with inhuman dedication in that crisis to curb the dangerous impulses of his nation's enemies, cheating on his wife, choosing to spend what were potentially his last moments on earth in the sheets with a random girl half his age instead of with his scared and vulnerable family. That doesn't sound like stillness. It doesn't sound particularly glamorous either. It sounds like a man who is spiritually broken, at the whims of his worst impulses, unable to think clearly or prioritize. But before we condemn Kennedy as a despicable addict or abuser, we should look at our own failings. Do we not fall prey to various desires in our own personal lives? Do we not know better and do it anyway? Lust is a destroyer of peace in our lives. Lust for a beautiful person. Lust for an orgasm. Lust for someone other than the one we've committed to be with. Lust for power. Lust for dominance. Lust for other people's stuff. Lust for the fanciest, best, most expensive things that money can buy. And is this not at odds with the self-mastery we say we want? A person enslaved to their urges is not free, whether they are a plumber or the president. How many great men and women end up losing everything, end up in some cases literally behind bars, because they freely chose to indulge their endless appetites, whatever they happen to be. And at least power and sex and attention are pleasurable. The most common form of lust is envy, the lust for what other people have for the sole reason that they have it. Joseph Epstein's brilliant line is, of the seven deadly sins, only envy is no fun at all. Democritus, 2,500 years before him, an envious man pains himself as though he were an enemy. No one in the sway of envy or jealousy has a chance to think clearly or live peacefully. How can they? It is an endless loop of misery. We're envious of one person while they envy somebody else. The factory worker wishes desperately to be a millionaire. The millionaire envies the simple life of the 9-to-5 worker. The famous wish they could go back to the private life that so many others would gladly give away. The man or woman with a beautiful partner thinks only of someone a little more beautiful. It's sobering to consider that the rival we're so jealous of may be, in fact, jealous of us. There is also a have your cake and eat it too immaturity to envy. We don't simply want what other people have. We want to keep everything we have and add theirs to it, even if those things are mutually exclusive. And on top of that, we also want them not to have it anymore. But if you had to trade places entirely with the person you envy, if you had to give up your brain, your principles, your proudest accomplishments to live their life, would you do it? Are you willing to pay the price they paid to get what you covet? No, you aren't. Epicurus, again, the supposed hedonist, once said that sex has never benefited any man, and it's a marvel if it hasn't injured him. He came up with a good test any time he felt himself being pulled by a strong desire. What will happen to me if I get what I want? How will I feel after? Indeed, most desires are at their core irrational emotions, and that's why stillness requires that we sit down and dissect them. We want to think ahead to the refractory period, to consider the inevitable hangover before we take a drink. When we do that, these desires lose some of their power. To the Epicureans, real pleasure was about freedom from pain and agitation. If wanting something makes you miserable while you don't have it, doesn't that diminish the true value of the reward? If getting what you want has consequences too, is it really that pleasurable? If the same drive that helps you achieve initially also leads you inevitably to overreach or overdo, is it really an advantage? Those seeking stillness need not become full-fledged ascetics or Puritans, but we can take the time to realize how much pull and power desire can have on us, and beyond the momentary pleasure this might provide us, it deprives us of the deeper peace that we seek. Think about the times when you felt best. It's not when you are pining away. It's not when you get what you pined for either. There is always a tinge of disappointment or loss at the moment of acquisition. Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita calls desires the ever-present enemy of the wise, which like fire cannot find satisfaction. The Buddhists personified this demon in the figure of Mara. They said it was Mara who tried to tempt and distract Buddha from the path of enlightenment, from stillness. When Leonardo da Vinci wrote in his notebook about how to portray envy, he said that she should be shown as lean and haggard due to her state of perpetual torment. Make her heart gnawed by a swelling serpent, he said. Make her ride upon death because envy never dies. It'd be hard to find a better depiction of lust either, which Leonardo said puts us on the level of beasts. None of us are perfect. We have biologies and pathologies that will inevitably trip us up. What we need then is a philosophy and a strong moral code, that sense of virtue, to help us resist what we can and to give us the strength to pick ourselves back up when we fail and to try to do and be better. We can also rely on tools to help us resist harmful desires. Saint Athanasius of Alexandria wrote in his Vita Antoni that one of the benefits of journaling, confessions, as the Christians called the genre, was that it helped him stop from sinning. By observing and then writing about his own behavior, he was able to hold himself accountable and make himself better. Let us each note and write down our actions and impulses of the soul as though we were to report them to each other, and you may rest assured that from utter shame of becoming known, we shall stop sinning and entertaining sinful thoughts altogether. Just as we would not give ourselves to lust within sight of each other, so if we were to write down our thoughts as if telling them to each other, we shall so much the more guard ourselves against foul thoughts for shame of being known. Now then, let the written account stand for the eyes of our fellow ascetics, so that blushing at writing the same as if we were actually seen, we may never ponder evil. To have an impulse and to resist it, to sit with it and examine it, to let it pass by like a bad smell, this is how we develop spiritual strength. This is how we become who we want to be in this world. Only those of us who take the time to explore, to question, to extrapolate the consequences of our desires have an opportunity to overcome them and stop regrets before they start. Only they know that real pleasure lies in having a soul that's true and stable, happy and secure. Enough. History relates no instance in which a conqueror has been surfeited with conquests. Stefan Zweig. The writers Kurt Vonnegut, the author of Slaughterhouse-Five, and Joseph Heller, the author of Catch-22, were once at a party in a fancy neighborhood outside New York City. Standing in the palatial second home of some boring billionaire, Vonnegut began to needle his friend. "Joe," he said, "how does it feel that our host only yesterday may have made more money than your novel has earned in its entire history?" "I've got something he can never have," Heller replied. "And what on earth could that be?" Vonnegut asked. "The knowledge that I've got enough." Earl Woods called that the E word, like it was an expletive. In truth, enough is a beautiful thing. Imagine the stillness that sense of enough brought Joseph Heller and everyone else who has it. No ceaseless wanting, no insecurity of comparison. Feeling satisfied with yourself and your work. What a gift! Saying the word enough is not enough. Deeply spiritual, introspective work is required to understand what that idea means. Work that may well destroy illusions and assumptions we have held our entire lives. John Stuart Mill, the philosopher and boy genius, who before he hit puberty, read and mastered nearly every major classical text in the original Greek or Latin, is an illustration of just how terrifying this process can be. Extremely driven by his father and by himself, one day at around 20 years old, Mill stopped to think for the first time about what he was chasing. As he writes, "It occurred to me to put the question directly to myself. Suppose that all your objects in life were realized, that all the changes in institutions and opinions which you are looking forward to could be completely effected at this very instant. Would this be a great joy and happiness to you?" And an irrepressible self-consciousness distinctly answered, "No." At this, my heart sank within me. The whole foundation on which my life was constructed fell down. What ensued was a devastating mental breakdown that required years of recovery. Yet Mill was probably lucky to undergo it so early. Most people never learn that their accomplishments will ultimately fail to provide the relief and happiness we tell ourselves they will. Or they come to understand this only after so much time and money, so many relationships and moments of inner peace were sacrificed on the altar of achievement. We get to the finish line only to think, "This is it. Now what?" It is a painful crossroads, or worse, one that we ignore, stuffing those feelings of existential crisis down, piling on top of them meaningless consumption, more ambition, and the delusion that doing more and more of the same will eventually bring about different results. In a way, this is a curse of one of our virtues. No one achieves excellence or enlightenment without a desire to get better, without a tendency to explore potential areas of improvement. Yet the desire or the need for more is often at odds with happiness. Billie Jean King, the tennis great, has spoken about this, about how the mentality that gets an athlete to the top so often prevents them from enjoying the thing they worked so hard for. The need for progress can be the enemy of enjoying the process. There is no stillness for the person who cannot appreciate things as they are, particularly when that person has objectively done so much. The creep of more, more, more is like a hydra. Satisfy one, lop it off the bucket list, and two more grow in its place. The best insights on enough come to us from the East. When you realize there is nothing lacking, Lao Tzu says, the whole world belongs to you. The verse in the Tao Te Ching, the greatest misfortune is to not know contentment. The word calamity is the desire to acquire. And so those who know the contentment of contentment are always content. The Western philosophers wrestled with the balance between getting more and being satisfied. Epicurus, nothing is enough for the man to whom enough is too little. Thomas Traherne, to have blessings and to prize them is to be in heaven. To have them and not prize them is to be in hell. To prize them and not have them is to be in hell. And the Stoics, who lived in the material world of an empire at its peak, knew the truth about money. Seneca had piles of it, and he knew how little it correlated with peace. His work is filled with stories of people who drove themselves to ruin and misery, chasing money they didn't need and honors beyond their share. Temperance, that's the key. Intellectually, we know this. It's only in flashes of insight or tragedy that we feel it. In 2010, Marco Rubio was pacing the halls of his home, making fundraising calls for his surprise Senate bid, when his three-year-old son snuck out the back door and fell into the pool. Rubio had heard the chime of the door opening, assumed someone else was paying attention, and returned to his important phone call. A few minutes later, he found his son floating face down in the pool, barely breathing. Even after this near tragedy, he returned almost immediately to work. His ambition, like Lincoln's, a little engine that knew no rest. Only with distance could Rubio begin to see the cost of this drive, what important things we miss when we give ourselves over to it entirely. As he wrote, "I think I understand now that the restlessness we feel as we make our plans and chase our ambitions is not the effect of their importance to our happiness and our eagerness to attain them. We are restless because deep in our hearts we know now that our happiness is found elsewhere, and our work, no matter how valuable it is to us or to others, cannot take its place. But we hurry on anyway and attend to our business because we need to matter, and we don't always realize we already do." Have you ever held a gold medal or a Grammy or a Super Bowl ring? Have you ever seen a bank balance nudging up into the seven figures? Maybe you have. Maybe you possess these things yourself. If you do, then you know. They are nice, but they change nothing. They are just pieces of metal, dirty paper in your pocket, or plaques on a wall. They are not made of anything strong or malleable enough to plug even the tiniest hole in a person's soul, nor do they extend the length of one's life even 1 minute. On the contrary, they may shorten it. They can also take the joy out of the thing we used to love to do. More does nothing for the one who feels less than, who cannot see the wealth that was given to them at birth, that they have accumulated in their relationships and experiences. Solving your problem of poverty is an achievable goal and can be fixed by earning and saving money. No one could seriously claim otherwise. The issue is that when we think these activities can address spiritual poverty. Accomplishments, money, fame, respect, piles and piles of them will never make a person feel content. If you believe that there is ever some point where you will feel like you've made it, when you'll finally be good, you are in for an unpleasant surprise. Or worse, a sort of Sisyphean torture where just as that feeling appears to be within reach, the goal is moved just a little bit further up the mountain and out of reach. You will never feel okay by way of external accomplishments. Enough comes from the inside. It comes from stepping off the train, from seeing what you already have, what you've always had. If a person can do that, they are richer than any billionaire, more powerful than any sovereign. Yet instead of seizing this path to power, we choose ingratitude and the insecurity of needing more, more, more. We are here as if immersed in water, head and shoulders underneath the great oceans, said the Zen master Gensha. And yet, how piteously we are extending our hands for water. We think we need more and don't realize we already have so much. We work so hard for our families that we don't notice the contradiction, that it's because of work that we never see them. Enough. Now, there is a perfectly understandable worry that contentment will be the end of our careers, that if we somehow satisfy this urge, all progress in our work and in our lives will come to a screeching halt. If everyone felt good, why would they keep trying so hard? First, it must be pointed out that this worry itself is hardly an ideal state of mind. No one does their best work driven by anxiety, and no one should be breeding insecurity in themselves so that they might keep making things. That is not industry. That is slavery. We were not put on this planet to be worker bees, compelled to perform some function over and over again for the cause of the hive until we die. Nor do we owe it to anyone to keep doing, doing, doing. Not our fans, not our followers, not our parents who've provided so much for us, not even our families. Killing ourselves does nothing for anybody. It's perfectly possible to do and make good work from a good place. You can be healthy and still and successful. Joseph Heller believed he had enough, but he still kept writing. He wrote 6 novels after Catch-22. When a reporter criticized him by saying he hadn't written anything as good as his first book, Heller replied, "Who has?" Including a number one bestseller. He taught. He wrote plays and movies. He was incredibly productive. John Stuart Mill, after his breakdown, fell in love with poetry, met the woman who would eventually become his wife, and began to slowly return to political philosophy, and ultimately had enormous impact on the world. Indeed, Western democracies are indebted to him for many changes he helped bring about. The beauty was that these creations and insights came from a better, a stiller place inside both men. They weren't doing it to prove anything. They didn't need to impress anyone. They were in the moment. Their motivations were pure. There was no insecurity, no anxiety, no creeping, painful hope that this would finally be the thing that would make them feel whole, that would give them what they had always been lacking. What do we want more of in life? That's the question. It's not accomplishments. It's not popularity. It's moments when we feel like we are enough. More presence, more clarity, more insight, more truth, more stillness. Bathe in beauty. In the face of the sublime, we feel a shiver, something too large for our minds to encompass. And for a moment, it shakes us out of our smugness and releases us from the death-like grip of habit and banality. Robert Greene. On Wednesday morning, February 23rd, 1944, Anne Frank climbed up to the attic above the annex where her family had been hiding for 2 long years to visit Peter, the young Jewish boy who lived with them. After Peter finished his chores, the two of them sat down at Anne's favorite spot on the floor and looked out the small window to the world they had been forced to leave behind. Staring at the blue sky, the leafless chestnut tree below, birds swooping and diving in the air, the two were entranced to the point of speechlessness. It was so quiet, so serene, so open compared to their cramped quarters. It was almost as if the world wasn't at war, as if Hitler had not already killed so many millions of people and their families didn't spend each day at risk of joining the dead. Despite it all, beauty seemed to reign. As long as this exists, Anne thought to herself, this sunshine and this cloudless sky, as long as I can enjoy it, how can I be sad? She would later write in her diary that nature was a kind of cure-all, a comfort available to any and all who suffer. Indeed, whether it was the blooming of spring or the starkness of winter, even when it was dark and raining, even when it was too dangerous to open the window and she had to sit in the stifling, suffocating heat to do it, Anne always managed to find in nature something to boost her spirits and center herself. Beauty remains, even in misfortune, she wrote. If you just look for it, you discover more and more happiness and regain your balance. How true that is. and what a source of peace and strength it can be. The trackless woods, a quiet child lying on her belly, reading a book, the clouds cutting over the wing of an airplane, its exhausted passengers all asleep, a man reading in his seat, a woman sleeping, a stewardess resting her feet, the rosy fingertips of dawn coming up over the mountain, a song on repeat. That song's beat lining up exactly with the rhythm of events, the pleasure of getting an assignment in before a deadline, the temporary quiet of an empty inbox. This is stillness. Rose Lane Wilder wrote of looking out over the grassy plateau in Tbilisi, the capital of Georgia. Here was only sky and a stillness made audible by the brittle grass. Emptiness was so perfect all around me that I felt a part of it, empty myself. And there was a moment in which I was nothing at all, almost nothing at all. The term for this is ecstasis, a heavenly experience that lets us step outside ourselves. And these beautiful moments are available to us whenever we want them. All we have to do is open our souls to them. There is a story about the Zen master Hayakujo, who was approached by two students as he began his morning chores on the farm attached to his temple. When the students asked him to teach them about the way, he replied, "You open the farm for me, and I will talk to you about the great principle of Zen." After they finished their labors and walked to the master for their lesson, he simply turned to face the fields, which the sun was just then rising above, extended his arms out in the direction of the serene expanse, and said nothing. That was the way. Nature, the cultivated soil, the growing crops, the satisfaction of good, hard work, the poetry of the earth, as it was in the beginning, as it will be forever. Not that all beauty is so immediately beautiful. We're not